My name's Craig. I'm an alcoholic and a drug addict. You know, my sponsor told me a while back that when you speak at something like this, there's generally three groups of people. There's the people who will like you no matter what you say. There's the people who will not like you no matter what you say. And then there's the people who really haven't made up their minds. And those are the ones you want to try to piss off if you can. I'm always a little amazed to be flown someplace so that somebody can listen to me talk. Because before I got sober, there were people who were willing to fly me someplace else so they wouldn't have to anymore. And it just never ceases to be astonishing to me. Thank you for having me up here. It's an honor. Some of the very first memories that I ever have, I never felt comfortable. Long before I ever took a drink or a drug, I never felt comfortable. I always felt shy, introverted, afraid, insecure, like I didn't fit in. I was always afraid to fight. I was really intimidated by confrontations with people. And I had all these wimpy feelings, you know, not the kind of feelings that other people around me seemed to have. I'd look at even other little kids, you know, and they seemed to just be doing what they were doing without thinking so much like I did. And the way that I dealt with that, and I was never honest with anybody about any of this stuff, I looked at how I perceived they were, and then I began to make up a person that fit what I thought other people were like. And I would watch a television show, and I would take a little piece of this person, and I would see a movie, and I would take a little piece of that, and I'd take a line that I heard from somewhere, and I'd take, you know, the one cool kid at school said something, and I would take that, and I would take all that stuff, and I used it to construct a person. And that was who I became. And part of this person was this tough guy. And that was problematic because as I went through life, I began to run into people who really were tough guys, especially in the circles that I ran in. And when they saw somebody like me who was just pretending to be, it often led to, you know, violence. Now, the problem is I was a wimp. But when I would drink and do drugs, I would forget that. I'd start, and that was part of the magic that happened with me with alcohol and other drugs, is that when I would drink, even though I knew I was a phony and a fraud, that the person who I was pretending to be, I would become that person when I was loaded. And I didn't need to go to school to learn anything, because as far as I was concerned, I knew everything. And I didn't need to make sacrifices to learn lessons, because I didn't need to. I had it. And I had it simply by taking a couple of drinks, doing a couple of Quaaludes, and snorting a few lines of cocaine. I didn't have to do any of the work that other people had to do. I could get it by magic, through chemistry. But underneath it all, when the drugs and the alcohol and everything wore off, there was still that shy, introverted, afraid, intimidated, scared guy that knew he wasn't for real. I remember, I live in Phoenix, Arizona now, but I used to many, many years ago live in Long Beach, California. You can call what I did there a living. And I'd gotten arrested for a DWI there. And I was in a holding cell with this other guy, and as they took him out of the holding cell and started to walk him down the hall to take him to the drunk tank. God, that it sounds like somebody that I sponsor in Phoenix, and it makes me homesick, you know. As they started taking him down the hall, he cracked off something to the guard. I don't to this day know what. And the guard just beat him like a drum. Now, I was drunk and loaded too, but this scared me. And so when the guard, and I instantly transformed myself into, you know, the James Bond that I became when I was loaded. And so when the jailer came back to get me to head this off, I felt it only fair to warn him that I had a black belt in Kung Fu and he'd better not try that with me. This was not a good idea. But this is the way I handled stuff. You see, I would think if I pretended long enough and hard enough to be this person I wanted to be, I'd become them. As he was escorting me down the hall, all I did was just turn my head about 3 inches to the right, and that was all he took. He had me in what's called a chokehold, where they actually choke you until you go unconscious. And I remember just when I realized that I was about to pass out, I wanted to tell him, wait a minute, I don't really have a black belt in Kung Fu. I've just been afraid and insecure and frightened and shy my whole life, and I've been a wimp, and I just put on this act so people won't hurt me, and I'm just really, but it's hard to get all that shit out when somebody's choking you to death. So, and I woke up in a drunk tank again. It had become pretty common for me. I don't like to talk an awful lot about what it was like, for the main reason that a lot of the stuff that I remember the best never even actually happened. I do know that there were some statistics compiled by people other than myself, and I tend to rely on those. And so I know, for example, that I went to jail 53 times, 9 major felony arrests. I had 6 DWIs. I went through 10 wonderful treatment centers. I went through the psycho ward on 3 different occasions. I was diagnosed at different times as a manic depressive, paranoid schizophrenic, neurotic suicidal sociopath. Every time I took an MMPI, I came out a different kind of nuts. And every car I ever owned died of alcoholism. I have hit everything with an automobile that you can hit. I mean, I've hit trees, telephone poles, fire hydrants. I mean, I'm bald now. You can see, like, my head is kind of a first step up, like, all over this area, you know, all the scars and everything. And there's, like, this one big T up here where a tree carved its initial in me. And I was, like, walking disaster area, an insurance agent's worst nightmare, you know. I was always, the county jail was the place, like in Cheers, where everybody knew my name. That and the psycho ward. I like the psycho ward a lot nicer than the detox, because they give you drugs and they, you know, call you Mr. Shell and stuff. And yeah. Actually, I went through the hospital that Dr. Bob, one of AA's co-founders, started in Akron, Ohio. And then liked it so much, I went back, I think, 6 more times to that place. And a couple of times to their psycho ward. At one time, my ex-wife was in the detox, and I was in the psycho ward. And then at another time, she was in the psycho ward, and I was in the detox. Remember, we had this, I didn't plan on talking about this, but there were like 2 wings of the building that came out, and they opened up the windows so that we could have like this sicko Romeo and Juliet balcony scene across the courtyard. Of course, they didn't really. My window actually had this like half-inch thick steel mesh on it because I was in the psycho ward, but hers she could lean out of. I'll tell you about my typical day. By that time, what the hell is that? Oh, this is a strange place. My typical day, I'd get up in the morning. And I remember as I opened my eyes, the first thing that would greet me in one of my typical days getting high was just this sense of disappointment. I was awake again. I was not dead. Hey, didn't somebody tell me they put a glass of water up here?
There is
water. Ah.
I didn't spill.
Thank you. I'd get out of bed. By that time, I had gotten, you know, after all these treatment centers, I'd gotten kind of part of the first step down. I knew that I was going to be getting high, but I had made this, I'd come up with the idea that have the federal government pay for it. So I got on a federally funded methadone maintenance program. And so I'd have to drive to the methadone clinic. That was the first stop in the day. Get that out of the way. I was chronically running late for stuff, so I had one of those little blue flashing police lights like the detectives have in their cars. And to get to the methadone clinic on time, I would put it on the roof of my car and drive down the freeway. On a Toyota Celica. I didn't give a shit. People pulled over. I got to the methadone clinic. About the only thing I never got arrested for. So I'd get my methadone, and when you're on methadone, you can't get high on narcotics anymore, because you just can't. But you can still get just as high on cocaine as you always did. So then I would start the cocaine search, you know. I would start going to where, you know, go to Billy Bob's house and Jimmy's house and all over town and Smoot's house and trying to put the... First, I'd have to get the money together. I visited a lot of grocery stores, and I would, like, buy a bag of Fritos and write a check for $50, you know. That's the way that I looked at it, you know. I mean, I did that when I could. If I couldn't do that, you know, I would rob people. I was sorry that I had to rob you, and I was, you know... And the only way that I could, like, overcome that guilt was to get high again. Because when I wasn't getting high, my enemy was awake. My enemy was my conscience. And when I wasn't getting high, it was there. You know? And it was talking to me. So anyway, I finally get the cocaine. That sometimes took a while. I look back on it now and I think I probably spent a third of my life before 1988, waiting in cars in parking lots of housing projects, you know, just waiting in car without knowing that whoever's in there, you know what they're doing. They're doing your shit, you know, and you can't do anything about it because you don't even know which apartment they went into. Then like 2 hours later, they come back out with whatever's left, you know, and then I would go home and then I would do the cocaine. And then the real evening's entertainment would start. My favorite sport after the cocaine was gone was the 50-meter freestyle carpet search. I love that. That was fun for me. I had this technique down, two carpet fibers back, one over, two back, one over. And I had the cleanest goddamn rug in Akron, Ohio. And I would do that like for hours and stuff, you know. And then the worst thing that could happen is God help you if you actually find something in the rug, because then you know there's more there. I just have to be diligent and look harder. At some time during doing this shit, I can't really explain this today, but you know, if you're in CA, you probably understand it. I would get this feeling that bugs were crawling on me. This would require the removal of all my clothing. And, you know, so you picture this, you know, I'm naked, you know, my skinny ass weighs about 135 pounds, I'm on the Peruvian diet plan, and I'm crawling around on the rug with my smelly naked ass up in the air, looking for just some little rock, some little piece that I missed, you know. I mean, I shot up stuff I knew wasn't even cocaine, but I just thought, maybe, you know. See, I had faith even then. And then I would start the next part of the night, which was the window peeking contest. And I swear, there was this one bush in my backyard that I knew was a bush. In the clear light of day, there wasn't any question that it was a bush. But at night, if you peeked out that window long enough, the bush was not a bush anymore. It was a person out in my backyard, and every time the wind would blow it, it'd go. After a while, this got me really crazy, you know? So it was time for the next stage in the evening, which was night patrol. And if you can picture this, I'm still naked, smelly, and tweaked out. Now I've got a loaded 9mm automatic pistol round in the chamber, hammer back, safety off, and I'm going out the back door of my house like this. Now, I have no idea why I'm doing it that way, except I watch a lot of cop shows, and that's the way they did it. And I felt like it was important to live the part, you know? And I would creep over to the one tree, and I would look, you know, like this around the tree, and there's nothing there. And then I'd creep around to get behind this sinister bush. And then I'd make my way all around the backyard, and then determine to my satisfaction that the bush was really a bush. And I felt a sense of relief until I got to the back door and realized I'd left it unlocked and they were inside the house now. So I'd start in the basement and I'd work my way on up to the top floor into the attic, and then God help me if I missed a closet, because then I'd have to do it all over again, you know? I was a very busy guy. You know, I had a lot of stuff to do. I don't know how I found time to do any. I certainly didn't work. I have a lot of respect for people who were cocaine addicts who worked. I did not do that. I couldn't do that, you know? I mean, if you call cash and hot checks work, I guess I did that. But then one day, I came back to the house, and the door was busted open. And when I went inside the house, on the wall was nailed a document from the United States District Court in Cleveland, Ohio. And it was a search warrant to search my house for guns with silencers on them, drugs, just a lot of really ugly stuff, you know. And I knew that they were there, or they had been there. So it was time for me not to be. And I got in the car and took off, and I went to this hotel about 50 miles away, and, you know, and did what I did when I was at my house, only now I'm doing it in a hotel room, and it's even worse because there's a window on either side of the hotel room. And I'm peeking out the windows one day. I'd been there a couple of days, and I look out one window and I see these two guys moving across the parking lot towards my front door. And I run over to the other window and I look out there, and here's three more moving up that way. And sure enough, "Mr. Shell, we have a warrant for your arrest." And they came in, and I was arrested by the, the Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms people, the ATF, my buds. I like to call it my federally funded intervention. But anyway, they came in the door, and there's a lesson in this, and what that is that if you peek out the windows long enough, one day they really will be out there. You just got to stick to it, you know? So anyway, tell you about my first trip to detox. I had wrecked a car again. I'd broken my right leg again. I had a bar, still do, as a matter of fact, in my right tibia from a motorcycle accident. When I wrecked the car, it bent my leg around into a U shape. Of course, it didn't snap back because there's a big metal bar down the middle of the leg. That's how I look when they pull me out of the car. Took me to the hospital. All I'm thinking of is this is going to be a Demerol time for sure. You know, I'm not even thinking about what I've done to my leg. I'm thinking about what kind of drugs I'm going to get when I get to the hospital. And I stay there for about 4 or 5 days on the medical ward. And then one day the doctor comes by and he goes, "Look, what I would do is I had this watch with a timer on it. And I knew they could only give me a shot every 3 hours. So I would sit there and clock it. 2 hours, 59 minutes, 59 seconds. Beep, 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 beep. Nurse, I'm in so much pain." I became so good at that kind of drama. Anybody here a dramatic addict? You know? So finally, after about 5 days of this shit, the doctor comes to my room and he says, "Look, we're not absolutely positive, but we think you're a drug addict." I was like, I'm insulted by that. And he goes, "Well, what we're going to do is either you're going to go up to the detox ward on the fifth floor, in which case we will take you off the drug slowly, or we're going to discharge you right now and I'm not giving you any kind of medication to take home." I was like, it was a difficult decision. Let's see. Door number one, no drugs at all. Door number two, not as much drugs, but at least some. You know, it's an easy choice. yeah, I'd like to go up to the detox ward. And I mean, it was weird, you know, and I'm going up. Now, I had, when I was in the hospital, oh, man, it was set up. I had, like, there was, like, an IV running into my arm. And while I was in the hospital, I would shoot cocaine and Dilaudid into the IV. And it was great. I mean, I wanted one to take home. And this is perfect. But then sometimes when they took the IV out, I had to start using my arms. So I had needle holes all over my arms. And plus, I had a lot on there from when I came into the hospital. And I got to the detox ward, and they're giving me the intake interview, you know. And actually, this was Akron City Hospital in Akron, Ohio, which I later found out that was the place where the very first 12-step call was ever paid. And that's where my journey to sobriety began. And I went in there, and the doctor's interviewing me, and he's looking at all these needle holes. And I'm just, like, mystified. I mean, we're going up in the elevator, and there's the doors open on this new way of life, and there's these little signs on the wall, like, you know, keep coming back, and the serenity prayer, and let go and let God. And all I remember thinking is, like, Christ, man, I need some real help. You fucking people have taken me to a gift shop, you know? What is this crap? I don't need these little sayings, you know? And he takes me in there, and this doctor's looking at my arms and everything, and then he looks at me really serious, and he goes, "And how is your penis, Craig?" And I was, like, pretty loaded, you know, and I, like, was trying to figure out what the right answer was and didn't have a clue. And I go, "Well, I don't know, Doc. Fine, thanks. How's yours?" It's like, it's a weird question, but I'm in a new environment. I'm trying to play along, you know. And he goes, "No." He says, "No, I mean, did you shoot drugs in your penis?" And I said, "No. God, that is disgusting." Disgusting. And suddenly, even though I felt pretty bad, suddenly I was heartened, because I knew there was a whole group out of people out there in the world that I was still superior to. All the people who shot dope in their penis, I hadn't, at least. I got harder as the years went by, but at the time, you know, today there's probably some guy, you know, down in the homeless, well, probably not in Park City, but, you know, down in Salt Lake City in the homeless shelter, pushing his shopping cart along going, "Well, it hasn't got that bad yet. I still have this nice shopping cart. You know, if I ever lose this, then maybe I'll need to go to the program." But that was, as long as I could find somebody that was more screwed up than I was, I didn't need any help. See, I had no idea what being an addict or an alcoholic meant. All I knew was that I went through all these treatment centers. Is they'd go around in a circle in group therapy, and this guy'd go, "I'm Jim and I'm an alcoholic, and you know, I'm John and I'm an addict, and I'm Mark and I'm an addict." And when it came to me, I knew what to say. "I'm Craig. I'm an addict. Are you an alcoholic?" "Sure, alcoholic, Craig." "Are you a codependent?" "I don't know what the hell that means, but sure, I'm Craig. I'm a codependent. I'll be one of those. Now, can I go have a cigarette? Because I don't give a damn. All I want to do is I want to just tell you whatever it is that I figure that you want to hear so that I can get the hell on with life and get out of there." And I thank God that I had a sponsor who challenged me on that stuff and asked me what made me think I was an alcoholic. In truth, all the stuff that I just told you about, it really doesn't have anything to do with whether I'm an addict or an alcoholic or not. All the things I just described, the trips to jail, the insane asylum, the wrecked cars, the DWIs, those things are symptoms of the kinds of things that may happen to people who are alcoholics and or drug addicts. But there's people who get DWIs who aren't alcoholics. People who get busted for dirty urines that aren't drug addicts. I was talking to Mark today about friends that I had that they used to shoot dope right along with me. But I remember, like, Mark, this other guy, Mark, he got married. And he slowed down quite a bit. We didn't see him as much anymore in the group I partied with. And then he had a little boy, and then he stopped altogether. I remember going by his house and asking him if he wanted to shoot a Dilaudid, it's like morphine, and offering him a freebie, $40 on the street. And he goes, "No, I don't do that anymore." See, but he got high right along with me. So if it's all the podium flash, if it's all the, you know, how many treatment centers to go through, how many times you've been arrested, how many dirtbag things have you done, if that's what makes me an addict, then why isn't he an addict? Why could he stop? Because he's not an addict. He grew out of it. As I got older, I only grew deeper and deeper and deeper into it. And at some point in my recovery, it became very necessary for me to discover exactly what it really meant to be a drug addict and an alcoholic. See, the first thing that happens is that once I do any cocaine at all, I'm not going to stash the rest of it for the weekend. If you're not sure, there's a test you can take. Get a gram of cocaine. Lay out 30 lines on a mirror. That's a month's supply, because you're going to do one line. Okay, then maybe you don't need to do that. But if you could do that, if you can do one line a day for 30 days, no more, just one. It's a month's supply, remember. And you probably don't need to go to CA anymore. There are people who can do that. There are people that I know that bought a gram of cocaine for Thanksgiving and still had some left at Christmas. They're not like me. They're different than I am. You know, and the other part of that thing is that I have this mental obsession, is that no matter how badly I got burned the last time, I'm always right in line to do it again. Somehow, no matter how bad, I mean, when there was nobody that went through treatment with me who was more convinced that they would never get high again as I was. And yet, as soon as I got out of treatment, there came a day when it seemed like a good idea, and I got high again. And I was amazed when it happened. The third part of that is the unmanageability of the spirit, is that there has to be something in my life to replace everything that the drugs and the alcohol used to do for me. You know that feeling I was talking about before, about when I would get high, I'd feel whole. I'd feel like the phony person that I'd made up to become. And there has to be something that pulls the parts of myself together that makes me whole, that doesn't have to involve chemicals. There has to be something that'll do that. And it has to be a power greater than myself. It's real simple stuff, but I never understood that. I was so caught up for so many years in sounding good at meetings and saying the things that I'd hear somebody say something and I'd go repeat it. You know, because they sounded good when they said it. If I say it, then I'll sound good. That what my own personal truth was, what was really true in my experience, really wasn't that important to me. See, all I really cared about was how to look good. And that kind of thinking had to be abandoned. Kind of got off the track there. I started going to AA in Akron, Ohio. There wasn't any CA there. And I don't know if you have any meeting halls that are like the ones in Akron, Ohio or in Salt Lake City, but they're all in these like yellow, dingy little rooms. The walls are stained yellow from the cigarette smoke. You know the type I'm talking about. This is what AA was like in Akron, you know, and they have the 12 steps and the 12 traditions hanging on the wall, and they're all stained yellow from the cigarette smoke. And there's like these six or eight guys, and they look like they're 90s or early hundreds. They're sitting around, they're playing pinochle, and they're all stained yellow from the cigarette smoke. And they would say shit to me like, at jails, institutions, death, or you can become like us. I remember thinking, death. or what kind of death? I mean, could I get like a quick death, a painless death? Because I think I'd rather be there than be like you people. And, you know, we don't want to hear about your drugs around here. That was fine with me. I smoked a joint on the way home from every AA meeting I went to in Akron, Ohio. I didn't want to talk about them there either. What else? It's about time to get... I remember I had all these strategies after going through treatment all these different times, you know, and I became like a professional treatment center patient, you know. I had like a $100,000 a year treatment center habit. I was either going to have to get sober or I was going to have to buy myself a treatment center. And one of them, my ex-wife, Debbie, who's now, she's sober about the same length of time than I am, about 9.5 years, my ex-wife and I got this contract that one of these therapists came up with for us. Idiot. And the contract was, you see, we had determined that why we kept relapsing, it didn't have anything to do with the point that, like, we'd never worked the steps or read the big book. It had to do with we weren't being honestly sharing our feelings with each other. So one of the feelings that we were supposed to share was, when we feel like getting high, we will share this with each other. And, you know, we printed this out and we both signed it. And, I mean, it was a sunny day when I strode forth from the treatment center that time. And I knew it was going to be different this time. And then one day she came in and she said, "Craig, I really feel like getting high." And I said, "Me too. Let's go." Yeah. So much for behavior contracts. Anyway, didn't work for me. So part of getting busted by the feds, they had me on the hook pretty good. I was looking at my options in life had been narrowed down to either getting sober or spending the next 10 years of my life in a federal penitentiary, probably married to somebody named Bubba. So I became Mr. Willingness. I am willing to do anything. Oh, let's work them steps, you know. And I was full of shit, but, you know, they knew they had me. So they got me to do all these things. They got me to go to Phoenix, Arizona to go to this halfway house. I've never been to a halfway house before. I'd always just done the treatment thing, and I know what to do when I get out of here. I'm just going to go to meetings. And you know, and I go to this halfway house, and part of the therapy at this halfway house was, this dock cow in the desert, was that you had to get a job, like a job, you know? And, I mean, I didn't know anything about that shit. But I got this one job, and then it didn't work out. It was awful. And it's like June in Phoenix. It's 115 degrees in the shade. And, I mean, I'm hating this whole idea. So I moved up in the world. I got a job at McDonald's. And so there I am. I'm 32 years old. I'm the McBiscuit cook at McDonald's. I'm making McBiscuits and McFries and McSalads. Those are my specialty. Don't ever eat the chicken salad. Don't do it. It's really bad. And I'm making McChicken salad, you know, and I'm doing all this stuff and the people at McDonald's are like, they're enthusiastic about being McDonald's employees, you know, and they're going around and they're talking about these little McDonald's slogans and stuff. And I'm thinking, like, I need a gun, and I need to kill all these people. This is, you know, it's. But along the line, I'd gotten a sponsor. That was the one thing that I'd done differently. I actually had gotten the sponsors, an old AA guy, okay, prick. Anyway, just what I needed. But I got him by accident, like every other good thing that's happened to me in my sobriety, and. And anyway, one day, the day I was about 90 days clean and sober, and this little manager from McDonald's, this little 18-year-old bitch from hell, who's probably running the corporation by now, she sat me down and she looked at me very solemnly and she said, "Craig, I'm sorry, but you're just not the kind of material McDonald's is looking for." And she fired me. And so the first thing out of the bag is, like, I get fired from McDonald's. I'm like, screw this. I'm going to commit suicide. This is the only thing. So I called up my sponsor because I didn't want him to feel bad when I committed suicide. And I was just going to let John know, you know, and I told us, look, I just don't want you to feel bad, but, you know, I'm getting ready to commit suicide. And, you know, thanks for all the help. And, you know, I wish it could have worked out. He goes, "You're thinking about committing suicide?" I said, "Yeah." And he goes, "Good." So, and I guess at some level I expected a little bit of sympathy. And he goes, "That's a good idea. At least, Craig, for once in your life, you're thinking about trying something new and not just going and shooting dope, you know?" He says, "Look, suicide for you might be a good idea, but let's just wait, not so fast. And let me take you through the 12 steps first. And then we'll be done in a couple of months. And after you're done working the steps, if you want to commit suicide, I got a 357 over here. You come over and blow your brains out. No problem." And I thought, that sounds reasonable. I mean, as intolerable as life was, not drinking, not using, and not working the steps, as intolerable as that was, I thought I could maybe stand it for a couple of months after I got through the steps. at which point I was going to commit suicide anyway, so what the hell, I might as well hang around a little bit longer. And I did, and something happened. And I don't know what happened. I have seen people that apparently, from all outward appearances, did the thing more sincerely than I did, and yet they're drunk or dead. And I've seen people who apparently, they certainly needed this program more than I did, and yet they're drunk or they're dead. And yet I'm still here. And they're not. And I don't understand why. It certainly wasn't because I worked such a great program. That's ego. You know? If for some reason the grace of God has kept me sober 9.5 years. That's His victory, not mine. You know, when we clap, when people get chips, I hope that it's directed above. You know? I mean, if I could do it. I was out in California speaking in a meeting, and they have this tradition out there that when you get up and take a chip, they yell out, "How did you do it?" If I could do it, I sure as hell wouldn't be here speaking at this meeting. I'd have been home enjoying my wife and kids and doing it. I can't do it. I don't have the power to do it. One of the things that he got me involved with really early on was working with others. And he had me doing an H&I meeting before I had even really finished step 4, I think. And I'm doing this H&I meeting, and I had gotten a couple of people to sponsor. You know, I mean, at some meetings you go to, they say you have to have a year to sponsor people. That's not in the big book. To me, the big book is the great bullshit filter. You know, it's the great thing you sift everything you hear at meetings through. If it's not in there, it's just another alcoholic or addict idea that somebody came up with. It may be a good idea, may be a bad idea, but doesn't have anything to do with the program. Just some another idea. So anyway, I'm sponsoring this guy, Dr. Bob. Here we go, you know, tangent time. Dr. Bob had, I believe, 10 days sober when he went on his first 12-step call. You know, so where does it come off that you've got to have a year to sponsor people? You know, Bill Wilson had 7 months when he met Dr. Bob. If Bill Wilson had followed the "you got to wait a year before you sponsor people" rule, we wouldn't be having this conversation. Because he'd have got drunk long before the year happened. I encourage people, get out there. Of course you might, you know, if you're brand new, you probably don't know shit. But the thing is, they don't know that you don't know shit. And they may very well follow you along for a considerable period of time and actually take some really great actions, whether you know anything at all. Matter of fact, you may be so annoyed at becoming a hypocrite that you begin to take some actions yourself, not because you need to, but because you need to teach it to someone else. That's kind of how I did it, you know. I mean, it's kind of hard to preach at somebody about get your goddamn 4-step done when you haven't done yours. Yeah. You know? Good thing to get somebody through a 4-step is have somebody they sponsor start on one. You know? The hell was I going? Working with others. Okay. At about 9 months sober, the relationship that I had with my wife was about the only thing that I had left, you know, besides my big McDonald's job. And I'd lost that. And about 9 months sober, my wife, go figure, decides she's in love with some other person in the fellowship. And like, she's living with me and dating this other guy in the fellowship while she's living with me. And I'm crazy, you know. And once again, even though I'd been through the steps, I was at this meeting and I had decided that as soon as the meeting is over, I'm going to go commit suicide. I've had it. I can't handle this. 9 months, I can't stand seeing my wife around at these meetings. And I can't, it's just crushing. So after the meeting was over, I hugged my way to the door, you know? Like, cause, you know, I'm trying to get to the door and there's all these people in front of me wanting hugs and stuff, you know? Like, "Hi, yeah, I'm doing okay. How you doing, Craig?" "Fine, thank you." You know, and I get to the door and my plan is I'm gonna go take my car, I'm gonna drink, get drunk and smash my car into a concrete embankment at about 115 miles an hour. That's the plan. All I got to do is get to the door and I'm home free. I'm out of the pain. It's all over. I get to the door and here's this little guy that I sponsor standing there and he's whining to me. He says, I like my keys in my car, Craig. Can you give me a ride home? What the hell am I going to tell him? No, I'm going to go commit suicide in the car. You probably better get a ride with somebody else. Christ's sake. I mean, I know I'm worthless at this point, but I still owe something to the program that saved my life. So I can't let this kid down. I go, yeah, I'll go ahead and give you a ride home. And I'm giving him a ride home, and he lives just around the corner from my house. And by the time I drive, and we're driving, oh, and he goes, thank you. And I didn't know very much about what was in the big book, really, but I knew to quote little lines and stuff. So he goes, when you always say there's no mistake in God's world, Craig, what was the reason for me locking my keys in my car? So, well, I don't know. Yeah. And I knew. It was the only way I was going to get home. And after I dropped him off, hell, I live right across the street, and I was just too tired to commit suicide that night. And I figured I'll just commit suicide tomorrow after I've had a little sleep. And the next day when I woke up, I was very dramatic, okay? I admitted to this earlier. And when I woke up the next day, the thing that I thought was going to kill me hadn't killed me. And it didn't hurt quite so bad. And a few days after that, it hurt less. And a few days after that, and a few days after that. And eventually I got over it. Eventually I got into a much better relationship than the one I'd had with her. It's a strange paradox that usually if the drinking and drugging don't kill the relationship, recovery usually does. Although I don't think it's recovery, I think it's sobriety, which can mean two different things sometimes. But during this period, after I got divorced from my wife, I started dating girls around the CA campus, making myself available to carry the message to those wonderful newcomers with less than 30 days. Now, this one guy, this speaker came one time, and he was speaking. There's a room, 400 people, and he goes, "Well, all the girls with 30 days or less, please raise your hand so Craig can get a look at you." He thought he was going to embarrass me. He did not count on just how sick the broads in CA are. I got laid by three of those women. Poor Bob never knew. Yeah, because they were I was a challenge now. Oh, well, I'll get this one, And anyway, I had this one where I met the one, you know what I mean? You know, the one. Oh, she's the one. My sponsor, I tell him that now, or people tell me that. He's like, "You met the one? Oh, I'm so happy for you. Send me a dollar." Yeah. He doesn't work. This is why. He makes all this money from people in AA and CA meeting the one and getting a dollar from him. Anyway, I go to see him, and I've got this problem, and it's about her, and I'm trying to explain it. I always thought that I had to tell my sponsor all the different angles, spend about a half hour lining it all up for him, and then so he could give me my answer, And so I tell him, "Well, she loves me, John, but I don't love her in the way that she needs me to love her, but she loves me, but not in the way that I need her to love me." And he's just like, "Jesus." He's like, "Look, just shut up." And he says, "What we got to do is we got to go visit Fast Eddie. He relapsed. He's at the VA hospital." I told him to come and visit him. "And after we're done with that, we'll talk all about your problem." And I got in the truck with him, and I'm riding down there. And I started thinking, maybe I've outgrown this guy as a sponsor. I'm sick of him devaluing my feelings like this. And he never listens to me. I'll just tell him something, and he'll tell me some step that I need to work. He never hears me out. It's like he doesn't even care about me, He wants me into the solution before he's even heard what the problem is, like he's heard it all before. And we get down there and we go in and see with this guy, Eddie. And, oh man, he's pathetic. He's been through 10, 15 rehabs, more than I have. He's been to the penitentiary 12 or 13 times. and he has literally hundreds of needle holes all up and down his arms, and he's got this big boil on his arm from using dirty needles that the doctors have had to lance open to drain the pus out of, you know. And when we're talking to him, sorry about the imagery, when we're talking to him, he's still got a total plan. At this point, he's like 2 days sober, and he's like, yep, when I get out of here, I'm going back to school, going to get my counseling degree. Been meaning to do that for a long time, and I'm going to go help. And I mean, he's just got it. He's got, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. And it just hits it. It's just like, my God, that poor bastard. He's not done yet. He's not done. He still has a plan. And I was just astonished with that, to see that firsthand. And as we walked out, my sponsor turned to me and he goes, okay, Craig, now tell me all about your big romantic problem. I mean, I had to like stop for a minute and, I was mistaken. That wasn't really a problem. No, Eddie has some pretty major problems. I have absolutely no problems at all. My life is perfect. And he laughed. He says, you know, you're right about that, except you have one problem that you'll continually have through your whole sobriety. And he said, it's called chronic perspective loss. He says, you chronically lose perspective over this perfect life that God has given you. And you chronically will lose perspective over that. You will start looking at the things that are wrong. The thing that keeps you in perspective is working with others and sponsoring people. And it keeps your problems right size. Because if I start focusing on just the things that aren't right in my life, they get bigger and bigger and bigger. And when I focus outside of myself on how I can be of service to somebody else, those problems become smaller and smaller and smaller. I went through in my sobriety, I've gone through the full gamut of all the service work. You know, I started out getting nominated as a GSR and then went to the local district service committee where I learned the true meaning of resentments. I also, and the worst was the convention committee. God bless you all for doing this one. I know how that is. And you know, one thing I found out about the program, which is the steps and what's in the big book, is the reason that the program is so vitally important, it is the only way you will ever survive the fellowship. The people in here will kill you unless you have the program, because they'll just drive you nuts. Anyway, and I went through all that, and then I ended up on the board of directors for CA in Phoenix, and then really got to piss some people off, and chaired H&I there for several years, and ended up chairing H&I at the CA World Service Conference in California. Had that, got to meet Howard out there. We had some fun and went to all those marvelous. I mean, it's just like whatever your district service committee. I mean, it's like that, only it's like worse because it's on a national level. And it's an interesting deal. And I went through all this, and I found eventually that I was kind of getting burned out on that kind of service work within CA, and I started doing some other things. And one of them was I got involved with a program called Hospice. And if you think CA has a bitch of a membership requirement, in Hospice you have to be diagnosed with less than 90 days to live. It's a program for terminally ill people. And I wanted to learn a little something about life, and I figured hanging out with people who did not have had a limited supply of it, I might be able to learn something. And there was this one guy, his name was Jesse, and he was building a sailboat. And what I would do is I'd do the same things that my sponsor John did with me, with guys that I sponsored that were having troubles, is when they were getting all upset, I'd take them over to visit my hospice client, Jesse, and they would help work on Jesse's sailboat with him. And suddenly their problems went away. A wonderful, miraculous thing to see. And after a while, Jesse was never supposed to live to see this sailboat completed. But one thing he told me, he says, the joy that I have is in working on it. Not necessarily ever seeing it sail. I'll never live for that. But he was wrong about that. Because after about 6 months, we actually had this boat in a condition where it could float. We thought it could. That's another story. All right, what the hell? I don't know how I'm doing on time, but anyway, we finally got this boat where I took me and Patrick and Fred and Doc, some other friends of mine, and we all took this boat. Now, you know the funny thing about alcoholics and addicts is, now, none of these guys had ever mentioned to me any vast area of expertise they had in sailing until we were on our way to the lake to sail. And then suddenly they're all experts. You know, they're all like, you know, I hear, you know, Patrick sailed with Dennis Connor, and it's like, funny you never mentioned that before, but, you know, I'll give him the benefit of the doubt. Maybe he did. We go up there, and the first time we went up there, we couldn't even get the mast up on the sailboat. The stays were too long, so we had to go back, we had to get changed. Next time we went up, we're back in the boat into the lake, and I'm sitting up in the back of the lake, and just as quickly as we're backing it into the water, the boat is filling up with water. This is a bad thing, is what they call that in sailor's language. And water's definitely supposed to be on the outside of the boat. I may not know a lot about sailing, but I do know that. And what I noticed is we forgot the caulk around where the engine went through the bottom of the boat so you could see daylight down through the bottom of the boat. Not a good thing. Never said we were professionals, you know. But anyway, so we caulked it up, came back the next week. The next week, it was a disaster. We're back in the trailer into the lake. We really still to this day, we don't know exactly what happened. I think Doc was supposed to be watching the trailer, but somehow the trailer got disconnected from the truck. The boat floated. That's the good news. The bad news is they recovered the trailer later, the divers did, from 80 feet of water. The trailer went right down to the bottom of the lake, down this canyon. It was ugly. Jesse was pissed. But, you know, like I said, the divers recovered it. That was good. The fourth time we went up, we actually sailed this guy's boat. Oh, but before we left, see, there's some beautiful promises in the tenth step. And they're not contingent upon me thinking through my last drink or doing hugs, not drugs, or not getting too hungry, angry, lonely, or tired. They're not dependent on me or any of my mental strategies at all. It's all dependent on God, my higher power. And he says that when we've gotten to step 10, sanity will have returned. And that we're not going to be tempted. We're not even going to need to swear off. We'll be placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. And just before we went up to the lake to sell this guy's boat, his wife comes out and she throws me up a jar. And she says, here, Jesse might need these. He's a terminal cancer patient. It's a jar of 100 full-grain morphine sulfate tabs. They go for $50 a piece on the street. We used to call them shake and bakes because you could drop them in the back of a syringe and they'd be dissolved before they hit the bottom. You know, I'd have blown you for 100 hits of morphine sulfate. I am so sorry. I apologize. I didn't really... I didn't want to say that on tape, but I mean, there's just no other way to really get the point across, you know? I mean, this was the big thing, you know? This was the one that's like, oh my God, I can't believe... And all I could think when I saw him was, why now? They're wasted on me now. Why didn't... When I needed 100 hits of full-grain morphine sulfate, why didn't anybody give me the damn things then? Why is it now when I think I was like 5 years sober at the time? Why did it happen then? And the funny thing was, is because of the 12 steps of this program, those things were as safe in my pocket as they would have been sitting in the safe at the hospital pharmacy they came from. And it's not because of me or anything I've done. It's because of a loving God. It's because of the grace that He's given me. And that was better than any of the contracts that I came up with my wife, or all the A's that I got on my relapse prevention plans and treatment centers and all the other things that people had told me about and that I'd heard about that never worked for me. They were beautiful things. Now, my mom, as you can imagine, she was alive through a lot, and still is alive, for that matter. Actually, she's doing much better. But I owed her quite a number of amends because... The nice thing about ripping off my mom was I knew she probably was going to hunt me down with a gun and try to kill me. And so I owed her all these amends, and I had made what amends that I could to her, straight out amends. But But when that thing happened in hospice after we sailed his boat, it ended up in the newspapers in Phoenix, and my name was mentioned in the newspaper, and I cut that out and I mailed it to my mom as part of like a continuing amend that I do with her, and she was able to see my name in the newspaper, you know. I mean, my name had been in the newspaper before, but it was never good news. And this time it was something that she got to see. And when I go down there now, she's proud of me. I used to try to tell myself that that wasn't important to me. I didn't care if my mom was proud of me. It was bullshit. I was trying to lie to me again. It was important to me. And today she's proud of me. Hell, I might even send her this tape. Hi, Mom. There you go. Sorry. All right. I've had like all these little miracles happen to me since I've been sober that might not be miracles to you. Like I have a valid driver's license today. There's people clapping and shit, you know. Where else could you go where people applaud because you have a valid driver's license? Let's see it. You know. Yeah, with my real name on it, too. And my right social security number. I was a little sober a little longer before that happened. But I have I lived next door to my landlord for 3 years. Next door to my landlord. The last time that I moved, I did it in the afternoon. Not in the middle of the night at like 2 a.m., you know? I mean, that's when I thought you moved. When do you move? You move in the middle of the night, and leaving a forwarding address is a joke because you don't want anybody that knows where you live finding you, you know? And the only mail I ever got were those little yellow slips that told me I had certified letters at the post office. None of my friends send me certified letters, so I don't. Oh. Let's see. I had a couple of years ago, I started sponsoring these guys. They're like big rock stars, you know, or one of them at the time. The other one wasn't sober yet. But anyway, they had the CD that came out. And it's, I don't know how many millions, like platinum, how many ever copies that is. But he gave me a copy of it. And he said, when you get home, look at the credits. And I says, all right, that's cool. And I got home and I opened up the CD and I noticed in the first credit they had was to God. And he called me up and he said, did you read the credits? And I said, yeah. Yeah, I saw that the first credit you gave was to God, and that's good because if it weren't for him, your sick ass would be dead a long time ago and this thing never would have got made. And he goes, no, I just read the rest of the credits. And I said, all right. So I opened the thing up and then I noticed like, down at the bottom, there was a big other list of names. Down at the bottom was Alice Cooper. And then in the middle was my name, Craig Schell. And I thought, damn, it's like I'm in between God and Alice Cooper. I mean, maybe that doesn't mean a lot to you, but for somebody that would have sucked a dick for a bottle full of morphine, I mean, it really meant a lot to me, you know? Again, I apologize. I've really come a long way with using language around the house because I have a 2.5-year-old kid, you know, and my language around the house, you'd all be proud of me. It's much you're in God's victory as it is anything else. But I mean, he no longer like drops the F word, you know. Now, listen to me. Now I'm cleaning it up. It's probably a little late for that. This talk's toast. Yeah. I remember once something that I learned that I'll share is I was on my way in 1990 up to Seattle for the AA World Conference, and I was still with the One then. And we were on the train, and we were having like this little spat, and she was talking to these guys. She was 20. I was 35. Anyway, she's talking to these guys. They're younger guys. I'm getting really angry. You know, now I've been through 10 treatment centers, so like I've learned all the lingo, and I'm starting thinking. It's like, okay, when she gets back to the seat, I know the formula. It's like, I feel angry when you talk to other men on the train. In the future, I would prefer that you not talk to, let's see, anyone else except me. Now, it sounds kind of appropriate, doesn't it? I mean, it's phrased appropriately. What it really is like, see, the way that I shared feelings, isn't it funny how we never insist on being able to share our love? We never insist or fight for our right to share our compassion. Usually the thing we insist on sharing is anger. You just insist on telling somebody what we're sure they need to hear. And here I was again. That's not sharing feelings. That's attempting to be the actor who wants to run the whole show, wants to arrange other people so he can be okay. And thank God what I did instead of sharing my feelings was I just shut up. That's a spiritual principle which is in the big book, but it isn't phrased quite the same way. It says we pause when doubtful and confused. The funny part is that when I'm doubtful and confused, I'm relatively safe. It's only when I'm absolutely sure I know exactly what I'm doing that I can be dangerous to myself and others. You know, when I'm doubtful and confused, I'm on pretty safe ground there. So anyway, as time went by, I got loose from the... I'd stopped 13-stepping girls a long time ago. Funny thing was, a lot of the people that stood in judgment of that are drunk or dead now. And I'm still here. I made my amends where I had to make them, and I moved on. I had still did H&I work, but I was having no luck finding Miss Wright in the rooms of CA. Go figure. And, I was looking, too. I was one, you know, picking them out. And that was anyway, I was doing an H&I meeting at this treatment center. I'll tell you, I met my wife. And it was an adolescent girls treatment center. No, she was not one of the clients. She was one of the staff, and this 13-year-old glue sniffer, who was a client there, fixed her and I up on a blind date. We're married now. We have a kid together. You know? I mean, the thing that irks me, though, is like this 13-year-old glue sniffer had a better handle on what I needed in a woman than I did. That was kind of hard to swallow. But she really did. You see, she knew this person and she knew me. And there wasn't a bunch of ego crap involved. There wasn't a bunch of Craig's planning and all this other crap. There was just, you know, she saw that we were a good match. And we got together. And a year later, we were married. And 2 years after that, we had our first son. I remember after I met her the following Christmas, we were going up to Iowa. Her parents... I mean, get this, she's never even smoked a joint. Needless to say, she's a normie. Well, she's not an alcoholic, let me put it that way. She's never even smoked a joint. I asked her why. She said, well, I took a puff off a cigarette when I was 15 and it made me cough, so I never wanted to smoke anything again. Like, gosh, how narrow-minded. How are you going to know whether you like shooting heroin or not unless you try it, you know? I don't get that. Anyway, we go up to this Iowa. This place was Mayberry. One traffic light in the whole town. She lives on Main Street, which is right next to Elm Street. I mean, it's just like that, you know? It's like this, your town, USA. And we go up, and I told her, look, I'm really scared about meeting your parents, you know? And she said, oh, don't worry. I said, I've told them all about you. And I was like... am I supposed to feel better now? I don't feel better. She said, and then this killed me. She said, I sent them one of your tapes. I was like, oh my God. This is a setup. I'm going to get up there and he's going to we're going to have a hunting accident or some shit like that. And can you imagine the conversation she calls daddy? It's like, yeah, he's a convicted felon and a drug addict, but dad, he's all different now. He's totally changed. And we went up there and these people were so nice to me and they welcomed me in their home and they made me feel totally comfortable. And I mean, being around, I'd learned how to be comfortable around y'all, but I never learned how to be comfortable around normies until they taught me that. You know, it's a beautiful thing. A couple of Christmases ago, how am I doing on time? Anybody know? I'm getting close. I'll wrap it up here in a minute. We're sitting around and it's winter time. My wife at that time was pregnant with Cody, and she's about 8 months pregnant. She looks like a small letter B, and she's hanging icicles on the Christmas tree in my house. I have these two German shepherds, and they're laying like bookends next to the fireplace. There's a fire going, and I'm just looking at this scene, you know? And sometimes I'll just do that. I'll just step back and go, wow, you know, look at this. This, how did I get from there? And it's like, my God, I've become Ward Cleaver. You know? I've got it all. I've got the white picket fence, the wife who's simple, loves me, you know? I'm sober. I have a job that I love. And, you know, the funny thing is, all the best things in my life, none of them were the result of any of my plans. They were mostly the result of me just doing what I learned in the program and following my sponsor's suggestions, because he never lied to me. Well, he did. He lied to me about one thing. He told me that one time when I was upset about something, he says, no matter how hard you work the 12 steps, you will only decrease the number of assholes in the world by one, and that's you. That was a lie. So I'll tell you why. Before I got sober, the cops used to harass me and bug me for practically no reason at all. Constantly. I was always in jail or on my way to jail. That was my life. But after I worked the 12 steps, the cops totally changed. Today, they are nice. They're polite. They're easy to get along with. They haven't even pulled me over for a speeding ticket in over 5 years. I mean, that shows you how far they've come in the last 5 years. My wife was a sicko who needed to be committed to the lunatic asylum, after which I could probably live a happy life after that. Certainly be less expensive to only have to support one drug habit. Now, my new wife, she's amazing. Since the last time I went through the 12 steps, how much she's improved. She's really come a long way, too. Now, my parents, now this is really the astonishing place, is my family, I mean, when you go through 10 treatment centers, you got to have shit to talk about in group therapy. By the time I got out of my 10th treatment center, I had probably the most dysfunctional family east of the Mississippi River. You know, I mean, they were just really sick. But after I had gone through the 12 steps, they totally changed. They really came around. You know what? Today, they're pretty happy, pretty well-adjusted people who are pretty much, in some ways, better men than I am, my brothers. But it's an amazing thing to have. My mom, this controlling, enabling person that used to just, you know, she's really come a long way. She's a pretty decent human being. And I have learned a lot from her sober. Amazing thing. So that's the one thing my sponsor did lie to me about. Because if you do work the 12 steps and do it diligently and do it out of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, the world around you will change. And it doesn't even require that you believe that. All it requires is that you take the action. I'm going to close with one thing. I was talking earlier about the importance of sponsoring people early on. And even before I knew very much about the big book, I was working with others. And I just learned some like little simple bullshit things that I did with people. Anyway, I had a cellular phone in my car. Now, I couldn't afford to talk on it, but I liked it having it in my car because I thought it impressed people. Excuse me. But guys that I sponsor would sometimes call me up on it. Anyway, this guy Fred calls me up one night, and he's got this big problem with some crap. I can't even stand to listen to it because, you know, he's running up my cellular phone time, you know? And it's like, wait a minute, this is a dollar a minute I'm listening to you whine. So I didn't tell him that. That was really nice. I said, look, read page 269 in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and call me back after I get home. We'll talk about your problem then. I have absolutely no idea what's on page 269 in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. But I figure, what the hell, there's probably nothing there that's going to hurt him. See, you don't have to know a lot to be able to be of service to somebody. And I got home, and there was this message on my answering machine from him. And he goes, my God, you know that book so well. this is the funny part. He says, I read page 296 in the big book, and it was exactly what I needed to know. I remember thinking, Christ, even when I'm full of shit, these guys can't get it right. I said 269. He read the wrong page. So I figured, what the hell, I'll go over and get the big book down and see how wise I am. This is what I found. Page 296. Where derision, contempt, and pity were once shown me, I now enjoy the respect of many people. Where once I had casual acquaintances, all of whom were fair-weather friends, I now have a host of friends who accept me for what I am. And over my AA years, I have made many real, honest, sincere friendships that I shall always cherish. I'm rated as a modestly successful man. My stock of material goods isn't great, but I have a fortune in friendships, courage, self-assurance, and honest appraisal of my own abilities. Above all, I have gained the greatest thing accorded to any man, the love and understanding of a gracious God who has lifted me from the alcoholic scrap heap to a position of trust, where I've been able to reap the rich rewards that come from showing a little love for others and from serving them as I can. Thank you. Good night.